Wednesday, the 5th of August, Bell Noon. I am now.
I came into Fitzroy to join a group of people led by my wife, Mary Doyle, and my brother, Brian Noon, who were running an open house for homeless people in King William Street, Fitzroy. I came in the last weeks of 1970, but effectively I came into Fitzroy in 1971 and joined that household. And to give you the overview, then in 1971, the parish priest, who was the landowner, the owner of that property, the new parish priest, a man called Gavin Fitzpatrick, replacing the absolutely superb Luigi D'Estegno, who was the parish priest, who supported the whole project. But the parish priest wanted to then extend Sacred Heart School and make that the playground, so two terraces were pulled down. That's also the time in which the Methodist Church, and it was the Presbyterian Church, and the whole block was being flattened for Atherton Gardens.
Uh-huh.
We've got photographs taken in 69 and 70 and 71 of that as they're being pulled down and stuff like that. Mm. So then that happened, then that household largely moved here to 268 and 266 Gore Street. We wanted to keep the open house project going, but by this time there was a fair few people involved, and we split into two households, one at 79 Bell Street, which my brother sort of took on, and the one here at Gore Street. We couldn't, it was very hard to get a big property that was suitable. We would be three, four, half a dozen young people, and three, four, half a dozen homeless people as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then a group of us wanted to buy a place cooperatively, and banks couldn't handle that at the time. There was no provision for a group ownership.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably heard some of the others talk about communes and stuff in this area mm-hmm. and so on. But we found a very friendly bank manager who said, we found an estate agent through a guy called Lou Hill, who was working for an estate agent, who's gone to become a magistrate and maybe an MLC. It was Lou Hill.
Mm-hmm.
But Lou was, in fact, a tenant here in this house, and he knew it was coming on the market, and the one besides coming on the market, so a group of us decided we could between us buy the two, and we knocked a hole in that wall, so we had our communal house on. But then that went, so to give you the overview, then came here in 1974. Mary Doyle and I married, and by 1976 we had a baby, so we then started to cut back on all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we sold off that house, 266, paid out all the various shareholders, and Mary and I then bought this house.
Mm-hmm.
And we've actually been in this house since 71, and we've been the sole owners or whatever since 76.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then, in, just to give you the overview for now, that then in 1980, when Mary's mother became very sick, we considered actually moving out to Sunshine where she was.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided to stay, and we renovated. And the part where you're in now, this is the new work on this house. That was a four-room
mm-hmm.
cottage with a lean-to fibro, kitchen and bathroom where we're sitting now.
Mm-hmm.
We've got pictures of a fair bit of all this stuff, by the way. When I see these exhibitions down at the place in across Johnson Street lately, of maybe 14 photographs, and they call it an exhibition, I thought, if you put Mary Doyle's Fitzroy up, you could get 200
photos. That was at the Colour Factory.
The Colour Factory, yes. Did you go to that?
Yeah, that one.
Yes,
they're good photos.
They were fantastic photos. I was very tempted to buy a couple. But
yeah.
You just snapped that one as you went past. And the one was about 12 months previously of Italian shops. Do you remember that one? Did you see that one?
No, but I've seen some stuff at the Italian Museum.
Oh, right.
More or less permanent exhibition.
Oh, they've got that place. That's great over there. Yeah. Well, Luigi D'Estegno was the parish priest at All Saints in 1968, 69 and into 70. Went on, he also left the priesthood and married, as I had done, and became the key person, maybe director of Coazit, which is housed in the same building as Italian Assistance Association.
So the homeless situation in Fitzroy was fairly extreme.
Fitzroy was known as the very low socioeconomic area in which a large number of the homeless men, the focus was on homeless men.
Mm-hmm.
Homeless women gravitated a bit to, there was a hostel called Regina Chaley, run by the Catholic Church in you probably know all about all this, in Flemington Road. And there was, we better stop that and I'll see this, and one of the jam tasks. What was the last thing we said? Can you backtrack a second?
We were talking about Cohasset and the homeless situation.
Oh, the homeless situation is... the person who has a great story to tell about it isn't my wife. She was a social worker at St Vincent's, and she was the first social worker in what was known as the Drug and Alcohol Clinic. It was a very innovative move in the 60s to start a clinic especially dedicated to that issue. And, of course, the main focus were a large number of homeless men. Many of them were World War II veterans who had worked on the snowy mountains. And why don't we stop a minute and say hello to Mary? So that was a very good step forward, an innovative program. But she got to know a lot of the homeless men around here and so on.
Were they young or old? Mostly older?
We thought they all looked old. But, for instance, a couple of the men we knew very well, to whose funerals we went, so would have been 38 or 40. I'm thinking of a fellow called Charlie Davis, another one called Noel Black. They were both quite young, really. But the others would be, what would they be, returned men from the war? They would have been 45, 50, I suppose. They don't have to behave as homeless men in that way. So Mary and my brother Brian had worked for a while at Gordon House, and then he worked at Hanover Centre. So there were four or five young people in that group. Mary or Brian, I'll put these names down for the record, Brian Noon, Chris Tucker, Judy Chow, Bernard and Deirdre Slattery, they started this house on. And Mary became a bit of an anti-social worker for a while, you know, to get away from the institutional, try and do something on the ground, live in an open house and see how it all worked out. So eventually some of those guys came there, and we would have sort of a mixed household. We made the feature of having an evening meal to which anybody could come. That was the open house aspect. Not everybody could stay, they didn't have enough room. But there were young people around in those days, but alcohol would have been the drug of preference, and methylated spirits would have been the main form of drug for a number of those. You know, they would mix Fanta or something with the methylated. Anyway, that's to tell you how the homeless open house for homeless people project originated. But then as the 60s, late 60s unfolded, of course, the issue of the Vietnam War became a big one as well. And all of us were active in the various campaigns, and we had a Fitzroy Moratorium Committee, and a guy called John Davidson arranged the showing of anti-war films over at the Uniting Church. I think by then it had become the Uniting Church. I've forgotten what year did the Uniting Church come into existence? Was it? It was the Methodist Church, or was it?
Yeah, I don't know if it was the Uniting Church at that point.
No, it's very close. It's about the time of the starting. Anyway, so we had really quite exciting 6 or 7 years for all that stuff, you know. Then comes a phase when we cut back to being sort of a nuclear family and stuff, and we. A number of our friends from that activist era then started to move out, naturally enough. They were buying homes with a bit more space and so on. But we took an option to stay here and to send our kids to school here. Our children went to primary school at Sacred Heart and at secondary school at Collingwood College, which was then called Collingwood Education Centre. It was Collingwood is exceptional. It's a P12 school. And a very great group of teachers when we went there who had combined a sort of pastoral approach towards the kids who had troubles, towards also providing a stream, a chance to do really well. I mean, both our kids got into Melbourne Uni from Collingwood College and stuff like that. So we've been active in the neighbourhood all through, and we've seen the fight against the freeway, we've seen the establishment of one-way streets and the street closures and so on, and we had to fight very hard. People were motors would we had temporary barriers for a while, and they would come in and take the blue stone away and then drive their cars through it, and we'd go and put the blue stone back, and council would eventually. And yet people coming in now, we occasionally see residents using the one-way streets the wrong way. I think they don't know that they have a lovely quiet area because it was fought for. You don't just get streets closed off just by chance. Because that was a bit of a spin-off from the opening of the freeway. We had more clout to do that, the council, and a terrific mayor called Bill Peters, and you all know about Bill. So anyway, we've been here I just want to say something about all that sort of neighbourhood stuff straight away, yeah. To give you an overview of our time here. Mm. So we became active in residence group. I think we had a thing called the Gore Street Area Action Group, which you already have a talk on record from me for the Historical Society. But one thing we've done here since about the late 70s, I think, is we've had a Boxing Day street party.
Mm.
And it's remarkable what you can do by having one event a year, which you try and get people to come together. It's for friendliness and neighbourliness, but also for security. It's always better to know who's in your neighbourhood and stuff.
Yes, yes.
And that's, I mean, Barry's got a sizable album of photos over the years of that, and you could really trace this block over that 30 or 40. We've been here now, therefore, 44 years in this area. We came here in the 11th of July, 1971, to the south.
And there's still a lot of permanent residents here as opposed to rental?
There are a very big mixture. Permanent is an interesting word. A lot of people buy and don't stay, and a lot of people rent. But there would now be only one other person in this block who was here when we came in. Now, what's the block? How many houses are there? 10 each side or something. Plus flats.
And you were talking about the Aboriginal family in the house that's currently being renovated, though.
Yep.
Were there many other Aboriginal families in this area?
When we first came, the house where Lloyd Robson and Rosemary Kiss live, and where Rob Spence and Sarah and their family now live, was a boarding house. You know, the upstairs veranda and the downstairs veranda were closed in with fibro, and there were little kitchenettes. We've been in there, little kitchenettes. With those little cookers, you know, that you could put on a table with a sort of a hot plate on top and a sort of grilling thing underneath. And, we had a window broken by a young boy who we chased to see where he went, and he went back into there. We met his fierce mother and grandmother who said he'd done no wrong and so on. But they were Aboriginal people who we got to know. But over the road in those flats, Norma... had three children, and they were there right into the 80s. They grew up with our kids. They were lucky enough to get a house, I think, through the Aboriginal housing co-op. That's one reason why some of the Aboriginal groups moved out of Fitzroy was that they got opportunities for housing that were better instead of renting. Mm. What did you ask me about? Permanency in the neighbourhood. But it seems to be fairly mobile, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're not far from the Pastor Doug Nichols Church.
Yeah.
There. You would have seen many glorious Sundays.
When we came, it was already a Greek evangelical, use that word in the technical sense, not a Greek Orthodox church, but a Greek Protestant evangelical church, which must have flourished, I'd imagine, in the 60s and 50s. But by the time we were here in the 70s, they were all living in Bulleen and beyond and coming into church. But anyway, when they sold, and it was bought by, I've forgotten who bought it, Cantor, the bloke.
Cantor?
Yeah, the guy who's big in art and stuff.
Yes, I know. He was into textiles and furnishing textiles and modern design.
Well, then they took the Greek church sign off, and of course, underneath it was revealed Aboriginal Church of Christ, Aboriginal Church, Pastor Doug Nichols.
So it wasn't common knowledge until then?
Well, it hadn't been. We had heard, but we didn't know, you see.
Ah.
So I got photographs of that, which is now, that the sign's gone.
Yes.
And through the Historical Society, we ended up getting a plaque put on the church, you know, through the Council of Historical Society. Yes. And it came to the centenary of Doug Nichols' birth. They had a memorial service, and they asked could they use that church. And Rob Spence and I went to it. We did a fair bit of work to make that possible, because the then resident, Cantor, was very open-minded and let us have that. And they had a service there, or a memorial event, for Doug Nichols on that occasion. That's good, really.
Yeah.
And there's a new book out on the Aboriginal Advancement League called Fighting Hard by Richard Broome. And the opening chapter about Fitzroy, I've reread it twice already. I don't often reread chapters, but it's a really good little chapter or two about the early days of Aborigines in Victoria. It is, you know, we've known already, I mean, there's already been a little bit of a project in the council for look at the history of Aborigines in this area, but I think this little study has brought that together very well. So
just going back to your street parties, Val, how extensive is your block? Is it just people in Gordon?
We originally only took to between Greaves and St David.
Yes.
But I have to say about the mobility thing, the last few years, we aren't getting as many from the block because they sort of they come and go and stuff, but we've got more people who've been around the area for a while who relate back to us.
Yeah.
So you just get to close off the block?
No, we I think we might have 1 year, but all that council stuff's become fairly fraught and all that stuff. We used to park a car or two oddly so we could play cricket, and the police came down on us like a ton of bricks. I got a fine. But no, we now just have it. We bring out a barbecue and people bring out a table. A Weber, you know, barbecue, and a few chairs, and people bring the leftovers. Boxing Day, so they can bring the leftovers out. We run from about 12 till about 6, and they come and go and stuff like that. But I really recommend it. I think it's a really simple.
We used to have one in my block when we first came, but the council thing became too difficult because we used to close off the street for 4 hours.
Well, now with the trees, if you get 3 or 4 cars not to park, we claim that little area there.
The wide footpath.
And who were the people that were there, Val? What were they, young professionals,
when we came
families?
In.
We're kind of thinking about the change, you know, what it was like when you first came.
Yeah, I see you've got questions about food and ethnic and all that stuff. If Mary and I both put our minds to it, we could tell you, but there was the one surviving person is Maria Camilleri from a Maltese migrant who came in the probably mid-60s, whose husband died in the building of the Underground Railway, and she's been widowed 3 sons. But there's been quite a strong Italian group in the next block between here and Johnson Street, the Marascos and the Cardamones. I mean, they're families that have been around the area for a long time. And this Sam Maresco, you may know, he's been a character in the whole area. Sam would be a must interview, by the way. Is he on your list? All right.
Cardamones. So that's how you pronounce that.
Cardamone, they intermarried. The Maresco's parents are both dead, but Sam would be about, I guess, somewhere about 60 or so now. But he grew up and went to school here. But he's one of those people who remembers things, and he keeps things. He's got memorabilia from here to next week. Fitzroy Football Club especially, but also Italians in Fitzroy and stuff. He's really got... Sam would love to be part of it. I told him this was going on.
I'm interested in getting someone from the Fitzroy Football Club. We don't really have anyone connected.
But he knows, he really does know. He's not just the talk. I mean, he'll talk you strongly talk for a while, but I was going to say something else about Sam and that whole area.
Is he a racing man?
No, not that I know of. But it's an Italian group there, but a fair number of Greek people. The milk bar on the corner of George and St David, and the milk bar on the corner of George and Moore, which were both running and thriving when we came in here, and they went right down to, well, the one on George and Moore lasted into the 2000s almost, I suppose. But they were busy businesses, you know. We would go around and come and...
Would you use them?
We'd use them. We used both of them. And
and you get groceries and stuff there, not just sort of...
Yeah, fill in. I mean, there was no supermarket here until the 80s. Well, there was Coles down the other end. I mean, but I remember the Coles down the other end, you know, but they still had the stained wood counters and all that sort of stuff. So we've seen a lot of changes there. But you're on a thread. What was the thread about the changes in the area, the ethnic? Greeks were strong in this area. That's what I'm going to tell you about. Joy de Moussy has written about that. A couple of people have done. She gave a talk to our historical site.
She's a professor at Melbourne.
Yeah, she's an ace historian, actually, on other things. So I'm a sort of funny interviewee in a way. I mean, my own story is interesting, but I'm also kind of semi-professionally interested in the history of the whole thing anyway. So I'm happy to just, if this is a bit of a jumble, take it as you find it.
No, that's fine.
Is that all right?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's great. Because we're interested in both.
Well, anyway, the number of the Greeks are still scattered, but they're dying off now. But the number of Greek households in this sort of immediate half-mile area is still...
And you said they tended to move out to sort of...
Italians and Greeks, by and large, I don't know what the sociologists would say, but by and large, Italians and the Greeks, following what the Australians had done 20 or 30 years before, move out in a bit of an arc to the north and northeast, really. The Irish Australians, or the old Australians of Fitzroy and Cope, I think sort of moved up the line more than out that way. I think the Italians and Greeks, those are new suburbs like Bulli and Baldwin and stuff, are very, very strongly Italian and Greek, I think.
Who were the agitators for action for improving the neighbourhood, like the supermarket and the one-way streets? And were you the genesis of that? Or?
No, it was a very widespread social movement. It's hard to separate how it all happens, but the upsurge of residence groups coincides with the upsurge of the opposition to the Vietnam War. It coincides also with the upsurge of interest in Aboriginal rights and the referendum 67 and the support for land rights.
So do you think the Vietnam War thing was sort of a little bit of a catalyst for getting people together?
It was a very big catalyst. But I think the movement was underway anyway. I think I'm a bit interested in sorting that out, actually. I've been asked to give a talk to a group of what's called the old Paradians, people who went to the Christian Brothers College parade of my cohort. And the title I've given it is the Old New Australians, 1945 to 1975. What happens to that group, you know, as we grew up and so on. I'm born 1940, for the record there. And I'm born in South Melbourne, and I had the first 6 years of my life there. And we moved out to Bentley, and that was then out in the sticks. My parents were working class. My father was a fitter, had been a blacksmith. My mother was a dressmaker. And I got scholarships that got me into secondary school. Then I went to study to be a priest. And then, as you heard, by 1970s, I was left the priesthood and got married and so on. But I mentioned all that to say that something I was going to say about why did I go to where I was born? What happened to this cohort of people? I think you've got to look at things like the folk music revival is part of awakening of a greater sense of community. Mid-60s folk, it's all connected, of which the biggest catalyst is the Vietnam War, because with the Vietnam War, you actually got into, you were at loggerheads with the state, you were at loggerheads with the government and the whole social system. So we started to think we needed another. I think we had been brought up in a period of unprecedented prosperity, if you want that sort of comment, I don't know, but since 1945, most people of my generation, I speak for my generation, though our fathers and mothers still had to work overtime to get that money. It wasn't a piece of cake, the great economic post-war economic boom. They all worked after hours, extra overtime on weekends. But we did get more. We got refrigerators and cars and things and so on. And education. And then with the Commonwealth Scholarship, people get into university and so on and so forth. But it's also the period of this great anxiety about nuclear war. You know, we grew up since 1945 thinking that there could be war once Russia and China got the bomb and all that stuff. So I think there's a few things ticking away whereby we start to question the consumer society in some small way. You know, they want to move to communes and wholemeal bread and brown rice and brown sugar. Mary has a great story about the homeless men sitting around this table, which was then and there. And when she put brown sugar on the table, they said, oh, gee, you must be really going bad. And they all went out and bought sugar for us. But that awareness of, like, the environmental stuff is all ticking away.
Yeah.
We hosted here and had a group household. I remember people coming for the first radical ecology conference in about, I don't know, 72 or 73. People came from interstate. And I wasn't in that particular organisation, but our good friend Jeff Lacey was. And, you know, there was a period, I think, of people thinking about themselves in not just self-promotion. You know, I think they sometimes try to portray the protest movement as self-indulgent. And all the talk about marijuana doesn't help that. You know, people who promote marijuana as the symbol of the revolution, I think that's a mistake. Well, I mean, certainly some people went down that path. But I think there was a period when a whole group of this cohort of people took an interest in homeless people, Aboriginal people, Vietnamese people and stuff. There's a really quite a high moral aspect to this.
Which reminds me, Val, of the green movement in Sydney Harbour to save those Moreton Bay figs, which was an activist group coming from the unions.
Yeah.
This is, we are warriors, but we have a conscientious consideration for the type of work we're doing, and we don't want to take those fig trees.
Wasn't that a great moment, the green bands?
Oh, that, yep.
Oh. Yes. Jack Money.
Well, showing anti-war films to the locals.
Yeah, it was fun.
That would have generated a few conscientious objectors.
Well, as always, we did things like door knocking and putting out leaflets. We were into talking to people where they're at. Mm. But you also had the Greeks have always had a fairly left-wing group around, but there were Macedonians and Serbs and all sorts of groups, and they all had their own various internal differences and so on. But we got support. I remember a bloke called Slobodan, the tram driver on the Serbian side. He became a big activist in our anti-Vietnam stuff. But all that story, you know, it probably needs to be taken at a bit more slowly. And written out, I mean, but I'm happy to give you a few leads.
In terms of the activist movements around Melbourne for the Vietnam War, Melbourne must have been pretty strong. Fitzroy, I mean, must have been fairly strong in that, to the point of culminating in the moratorium.
When you watch movie clips and stuff about the 60s, they always show you clips about students, because that's, you know, a number of the people who have gone into media come out of that background and they remember that, and that's the stuff you've got, you know, confrontations and stuff. Yeah. But I think the strength of the moratorium movement was that it was pretty suburban. I'm actually backing away from saying that Fitzroy was good, but the strength was that you had groups in, you know, Moorabbin and
people of
Heidelberg and Sunshine and Preston, and I remember a discussion, somebody said, oh, they're all little old ladies joining the moratorium, not very radical. I remember Joe Broderick saying, that's the strength of it, that you've got the little old ladies. I mean, we didn't just have little old ladies because you had young people as well. Mm. But it was an extraordinary moment that you had people of all sorts and shapes and sizes. Mm. And
well, it's almost to the point where Fitzroy's made a commitment of naming that square opposite the library and the town hall the Whitlam Square.
On that corner where the Rolf McLean Memorial statue or whatever it is, I hadn't been more than a week or two in Fitzroy when I went around the morning to get my newspaper from the shop that's on the corner opposite the Napier, and it had been pulled down overnight. The demolition of that corner was done very rapidly. Then I think you have to ask the people who know council. I mean, Renata and them would know all this, but
Renata,
I then think the community groups got active and said, well, you're not going to put a development up there. Then the council, I think, bought that land. Does the council own that land?
Well, I think it's a public
controls
space.
Controls it anyway.
Yes, it's a public space now.
Well, just now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, sometimes you've got to sacrifice one to actually get
mobilised.
So was that the the beginning of the redevelopment in the area, do you think? What else do you remember?
Oh, the pulling down of the area
the big one.
That's the last success. That's the last time a high rise was put up. That's from there no further. Mm-hmm. So the opposition to that failed, but the opposition to that, but in particular Brooks Crescent is the turning point. You follow that?
Yes.
Just up past you.
Laurie
O'Brien.
Yeah.
And,
where they've got the lower rise.
Yeah.
Keith. who was also fairly in the Fitzroy History Group when I first joined.
Yeah.
So very involved in the
group. But the group around Brian Howe and Arthur Faulkner, are you aware of that little thing called, what was it called, Based in the Church? You know, Brian Howe came back, this is all, I think, in
the church in Napier Street, down by Gertrude.
Yeah.
Which is now in private hands.
Yeah, I see that. Yes. Urban Action, something they called themselves.
Yes.
Well, they, but all sorts of groups came in behind the Brooks Crescent fight. And that stopped them. They never did another high rise after that. And they did the walk-ups. They did the renovation of. Yes. I mean, some of the they just renovated old terraces.
Yes.
But they also built one or two levels to.
So they wanted to put a high rise in Brooks.
Yeah, up there. That was the, oh, they're going to put them everywhere.
When was that? Was that 70?
That's 70s. It's 73 or 74.
Right. Yeah. Because I lived in Alfred Street in 72.
Alfred Crescent.
No. Unfortunately, no. Alfred Street, just opposite the North Fitzroy Arms. I lived there in 1972 when I was a student at Monash, and that was Fitzroy was very different. Yeah. Well, North Fitzroy was very different then, so I'm sort of aware of it. But then I was gone for a very long time, and now I've come back to a much more gentrified area.
Mm. One group in that whole thing is the young conscientious objectors and draft resistors on the run from the police.
Mm.
I mean, we'd have had a fair few come and go and stay with us over those years. Roger Napthine, the brother of the former Premier, the draft resistor.
I would have enjoyed that.
Yeah, we ran into him at the Ex Libris, the book festival at Port Fairy, 2 or 3 years ago. I was speaking down there. And at the launch, he made the speech. He was the local member. But I won't be involved in it. And I said, I knew your brother. Roger's still alive. And he didn't resile. I was impressed with him as a person. He didn't sort of say, we've got our own ways, Roger and I. We couldn't, he didn't say anything. He just said, oh, yeah, Roger. He obviously respected him and respected Roger's friend. It was very nice. Yeah. You can do all this down, all this chit-chat.
Yes. I suppose we should, get on to it.
No. So, I don't know. That's... I sort of went to try to give you a picture of the years we've been here in one go. I mean, there's a million stories in between.
Mm. Bill, can you give us a sense of where you bought your things and how you bought them? I mean, you talked about the original coal store, having the original counters and so forth, and the local newspaper shop.
Did you do your main shop still then at Vic Market?
Actually, I didn't get into Vic Market. We had phases of doing Vic Market.
Because we used to shop at Vic Market.
Yeah, from an office street. And we actually joined a fruit and veggie co-op before Friends of the Earth started. We had a boat called Justin Maloney. He used to go down at 5 a.m. to the wholesale. There's lots of those little things that are now sort of thought to be just the latest idea.
Yeah.
We were doing them in those years.
Mm.
But then we must have, we shopped at Sammy Left Caditas's fruit and veggie shop. That's where we got our fruit and veggies, Sammy's place, in Sammy and Kathy. Sammy's just died. He's either related or closely connected to some of the Greek families in this area, but he actually lived at Altona. Mm.
Where was Sammy's in Smith?
Where the electronic goods place is beside, right at the bottom there, near the chippery, near the rock salt and vinegar. Mary would be better to, when you get to talk to Mary, better to ask her about where we shop and stuff. I'm a bit different. I got hooked into, I started buying from Friends of the Earth, which was, then Soul Food came in. You know, Friends of the Earth and Soul Food both started organic stuff, you see.
Because Soul Food had been there a long, long time.
And one of the guys who worked there then started a store at the market. So there are now 3 or 4 organic stores at Vic Market, but there wasn't initially.
Yes, there's quite a few.
So I still shop at Vic Market, but... But I mean, so give a bit of thought to that food thing. I haven't got my thoughts marshalled on fairly shots.
But yeah, but even the thing with the like the milk bars. There were milk bars in those days.
Oh,
I remember on every corner.
There's a story that some people can remember of this person going around to the corner of George and St David in his dressing gown to get milk.
Oh, it's a neighbourhood that we own and possess, and it's ours.
I have to say that I'm sure that we did such a thing. All the students, so we're all out today.
Well, I wasn't much older than you then.
And he's talking about his Asia file, I suppose.
No,
but I figured there's bound to be one.
Yeah.
Very busy little boys, Asia.
I was just thinking something now about, talking about food and stuff. When we had that open house, the homeless guys, you know, are a range of, some of those people are not right out of it, right? And there's a couple of them there, in particular Jimmy Scanlon. Scanlon or...
Jimmy Scanlon,
yeah. Jimmy Scanlon. Who had a sort of a shed at the back of Lamana's. There's another fruit, Italian fruit shop up there where, between Gertrude and... Victoria Parade, actually. No. Back from Gertrude Street towards about where that Japanese restaurant is now, somewhere around
Pico
there.
Pico.
Yeah. And that was Lamana's fruit shop. Well, he earned his keep by unpacking the fruit boxes in the morning when they came back from home. But he would keep us supplied with fresh fruit and veggies. I mean, the common table, people would bring stuff. Mm. And if they went to the Selvos and got given a loaf of bread or a cake, they'd bring it and put it on the table. It's very interesting how all that stuff has a momentum of its own.
What about the white sugar?
I've told them about the white sugar. When we put out the brown, they thought we were going so bad.
I just really hope poor old bloody customers said, you were really going bad, Mary, when you were put out brown sugar. So you probably nicked it somewhere. Because we were being pushed by the healthy thing that you had brown sugar, not that awful white stuff.
It's like
so all of your neighbours work full time?
What sort of jobs would that have
had? Oh, maybe back then, we're thinking, yeah.
Well, that household never had a grant from any organisation or church or government. We always... Enough of us were working. I had a job during, well, right through 71, driving for Sunnycrust, the banker. Mary worked at cardboard converters or something, what's it called?
Paper converters. But our neighbours.
Let's work our way through that.
George Watts was, well, until he retired.
When we first came.
Okay.
George Watts was sort of like the tally clerk down at the British United Shoe Machinery. You know that whole area was dominated, you know, near the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was... The thing about those units behind you, that converted warehouse and that grey-painted place was joined together with three-storey, now four-storey joint on the corner, which you probably know as... what's Dummett's, anyway. That was all Dummett's shoes, and we came in here, you would now be hearing clickety-clack-clack-clack, clickety-clack-clack-clack. Would Mr. Brown please come to the front and bring up the product, you know, whatever it was. So shoe industry was still very big. Leather. Mm-hmm. Printing was big in the area. But George was kind of... He must have been able with books and stuff like that, you know. He was in the Masonic Lodge, which was a feature of life in the area, and he would go out on Tuesday night with his dicky suit and all that stuff. I would think the British United Shoe Machinery Management was pretty much in the same train as George. But he was a great neighbour to us.
And when we wanted to do an extension, he came in here. This was a back veranda. And he said, what do you want to do an extension for? And we said, my mum might become the son. He said, is it something across here? You know, just close off a bit, it'd fit a bit in. He said, I spent most of my, or you wouldn't have said adulthood, sleeping on the front veranda upstairs.
George's mother had...
16, and before then he was living in a house in St David between Gore and Smith. So, and he lived till he was 95, so his whole life has been... But he, in 1983, 83 or something, or 2 or something, when we were doing it, or 1.
80.
No, 80. Was disgusted to think we were going to extend.
Instead of just putting the fibro along the front veranda. And
yeah.
He grew up as a boy, I would think, 12 maybe, Mary, sleeping behind a canvas blind on the upstairs veranda.
That's what that was.
You remember those canvas blinds? They had even little doorways in them and little windows in them.
Was that relatively common in that time? Yeah. The 264
was built out onto the 268, and we had 268. 264 was built out on
262.
And then 258, where the kids claimed it.
Oh, I'm sorry, 264.
That was built right out as well.
I'm guessing people didn't bother a lot with permits and councils and stuff in those days.
Oh, I wouldn't think so. No.
But they were rooming houses.
Yeah.
Or extended families. You forget how many. This site, you know, would probably have had 8 people or something, you know.
And that's what we're going back to, more intensive housing.
Yeah, we have to, of course. Yeah.
But Val, most of those people have full-time work.
So, Mary started. George retired midway through our time here, but he was a clerk. He kept some of the books of what came and went, I think, down at the shoe machinery. On our the 264 Mary, Ian Murphy worked at the brewery.
So people tended to work locally in the industry.
I mentioned Maria Camilleri's husband worked on the construction on the underground and was killed in that. Alma was a widow. We could probably do a bit of a run around to get some idea.
The two houses that are between 272. The two houses were all part of this, what is it?
Mattai Brothers.
Mattai Brothers.
Plaster statue business. Are they on your list?
No, just that
matter. Well, so Mary can be
there. I'm not sure if we're catching you, Mary. So maybe if you could move a bit closer, would be good.
No, that's right. I'm not going. Two seventy-four and 276 were part of a complex which was based in Mattei Brothers, M-A-T-T-E-I, I think, and they were plaster.
They're down there on Johnson Street.
Well,
May Pitchy is the one you're thinking of.
Mattei Brothers had those two houses, the church. And all the houses along Greve Street
and
then around into Hargroves were a whole lot of little cottages. And all of
that's a huge complex.
Yes, all of those little cottages, plus the two on this side, plus the church, were all Mattei Brothers plaster cast statues. And somewhere in them, I don't know when, 80s, late 70s, I don't know when, they sold. And they actually came in and invited us to see what it was like. So we went in and saw that it had been a church. You could tell it had been a church. I mean, it was still a church, just left. Filled up with statues of Our Lady and the Sacred Heart and all the ones that we'd all known when we were kids.
And, lions and Greek goddesses and stuff.
Well, and so they were all actually separate? They weren't sort of joined up inside the buildings? They were still all...
Oh no, these were still separate. These other houses all remain separate.
How they work
and they've, I don't know whether they've sold them, but they've certainly done them all up and they're all private.
They're all leased and maybe they're making
them. Well, you mentioned John Caldor.
John Cantor.
Cantor.
Yeah.
Now, he was in textiles, wasn't he? Opposite Safeway there in that street.
Oh!
There was big fabric. Textile place there, just
Bloom
around the corner.
That was Bloom.
Bloom.
Oh, no, Bloom. This
Bloom.
Year.
Bloom this took year, this after Dummers.
After it was
shoes.
Stopped being shoes, it became Bloom's textile. Yeah. But they only had the front bit.
This part
and
was
then,
five.
Then there's, you'd almost...
Remember that, like in the 80s?
Well, we could date all that for you anyway.
We fought the council and VCAP about Bloom
because
Bloom's was still there in 1991.
Yeah.
It you went upstairs onto our balcony, you'd be able to see the four-story building, which was Bloom's, this little house, one house here,
yes,
which yes. is the
one... Of which you should share one memory.
That's the only one that hasn't really been done up. And then two big houses beyond there that were done up to... Oh, like we were all sort of overwhelmed. It was the first time that the you could see from the balcony better, but those two grey places, they're enormous, and they were saying, oh, it's a full European kitchen. It was the first time they were selling things for that. The memory of this is, I don't remember too much about it, except that one summer night, I'm sitting, the couch's here, and I'm sitting there, Val's upstairs, watching the tennis, and I hear screaming. A woman screaming. And I call out to Val, or he hears too, but anyhow, Val goes racing around the corner, and I ring the police. And we're assuming this woman's being attacked or something, you know. And I don't know at what point Val finds out, but she has come in and found her husband or partner and hanged himself. And she found him in there. And he turns out to have been the brother of the guy who used to own the church.
Well, that's what I think of his cantor. I think
his brother.
When you're transcribing, make a note that we need to check that name, Cantor, and I'll check that for you.
It was just we've got that on the tape. Yeah. He'd moved out,
because he needed
some space or something.
But I told you.
She came to follow him.
But I told you that he was the one who helped put on the Doug Nicholls Centenary.
Yes. I think it might be time for a break.
Why don't we have a break? And why don't I take you on the balcony and mirror those things, just for your familiarisation, just for your familiarisation, just for your familiarisation.